You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It's been nearly 10 years since Peter Hoe Davies came out with his first novel, The Welsh Girl. It was longlisted for the 2007 Man Booker Prize. And now Davies, who teaches creative writing at the University of Michigan, is out with his second novel, The Fortunes. He offers us four linked stories exploring what it means to be Chinese in America over the past century and a half. Three of the stories are built around people and events that actually happened. The most gut-wrenching story is Tell It Slant. It was based on the 1982 murder of Vincent Chin, the young Chinese-American beaten to death by a baseball bat in Highland Park by a couple of angry auto workers who thought he was Japanese.
He was grappling with Pitts when Evans caught him across the knees as if reaching for a grounder, after which Vincent couldn't have run even if he'd wanted. Then a line drive to the chest, pop, as he went down, two more to the head when he was on all fours, swinging for the fences. I ran back, but too late. Before or after the two off-duty cops working security at the Mickey D's, Drew and Evans, you might wonder, me too. Vincent's last words, it's not fair, to me, in Chinese, while I cradled his ruined head, blood bubbling from his mouth and nose as he spoke, blood pouring from his ears like oil, his skull felt like rotten fruit. I thought I'd pissed myself, but the warm wetness in my lap was his brains. The blow to the chest broke a jade charm, a little carved elephant that had been his mother's, that Vincent wore on his chain. A bad omen to Chinese, though you hardly needed an omen to foretell what was coming next. The ambulance took him to Henry Ford Hospital, the same hospital he used to take his dad for dialysis, where he lingered for a few days, his mother by his bedside calling him, Vincent, Mama coming, Vincent, Mama coming, as if from a great distance, before she finally gave consent to turn him off, the same hospital where they told her 30 years earlier that she'd never have a child.
Peter Hoe Davies, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks for having me, Cynthia.
You know, that is a stunning, it's a horrifying passage and made even more so by the fact that it's true. And you write so authentically, I had to look up and go, wait, was he there? And I realized, no, you were in Coventry, England growing up when this happened. As you researched and thought about Vincent Chin's story and then wrote about it, what did you learn from it?
It's interesting because it's such an iconic story. And even growing up, you know, in Europe, in Britain, in 82 when this was happening, I'd heard of that story. You know, the town I grew up in, Coventry, is a car city, right?
It sure is.
It's in the Midlands of England, somewhat like the Midwest in the U.S. And I had friends in the car industry, their parents, who were worried about losing their jobs at that time. So some of that economic pressure felt at that time reverberated close to home. And so when I heard Vincent's story, even then as a teenager, it sort of stuck with me, I think. Researching it, though, you know, we move from that space, and I think this is part of the process of the fiction itself, the fictionalized version of the narrative. It's a way of taking this iconic figure, this sort of tragic martyr, but also trying to understand who this person is as a human being. And some of that is in my imagination, but it's an effort to present a kind of, on the one hand, a kind of warts and all portrayal, I think, of Vincent, but also in that process to humanize him. So he's not just this iconic martyr, but a real person whose death means a great deal.
And caused a real ripple effect because, as you point out, in the story, you had the two auto workers, father and stepson, walked away with probation and court costs. In fact, I recall Wayne County Circuit Judge Charles Kaufman, and his quote was, these weren't the kind of men you send to jail. You don't make the punishment fit the crime. You make the punishment fit the criminal. Between that and the fact that the ACLU and other civil rights groups, they never stepped up. What did that say to you about being Chinese in America?
Well, I think there's a real question there about how we think about race in America, right? One of the things that people resisted, I think, at the time, even the ACLU, was whether or not we could apply civil rights legislation that had been generated in regard to African-American circumstances, whether we could apply it to other minority groups like Asian-Americans. And it felt as though it was a really interesting moment there, partly for the Asian-American community as well, to think of themselves, do we align ourselves with the majority white community, an aspirational move, or do we align ourselves with other minority groups? And I think that was the choice that was made in that regard.
And it certainly galvanized the Asian community to come together. And I love the way you put it, that lack of action. You know, you had old hatreds and grievances put away. And as you write, two drunk white guys couldn't tell us apart. And we realized we were more alike than we'd thought.
Yeah, one of the really stark ironies, I think, of the circumstances, although it also means a kind of coming together and a bonding of the Asian American community, is there's Lily Chin, Vincent's mother, mm-hmm. who leaves China after the Japanese aggression during the war. She can't stand to stay there any longer because of what she's seen in the war. She comes to the U.S. She adopts a child from China. Her child is killed because he looks Japanese, and then she finds herself making common cause with Japanese Americans to protest the attack upon him, which is an attack upon him, but also, of course, upon Japanese Americans.
It's really a stunning story. You also, you begin the book, The Fortunes, Peter Ho Davies, with the story Celestial Railroad, about a teenage immigrant named Ling. And it's almost rather Forrest Gump-like in the sense that you've got him in a very key moment of U.S. history, and that's the building of the Transcontinental Railroad. And in that story, you remind us that would have never happened without immigrant labor, would it?
Yeah. I mean, I was really interested for years now, going back 20 years to around about the time I first came to the U.S., I took a train journey all across the country, which is really eye-opening for a European. I think it's important for Europeans to get a sense of the continental scale of the United States. You can only do that by feeling it in your bones when you've been sitting in a train seat for 3 days, right? And that's when I first learned about the building of the Transcontinental and the Chinese role. And I was very attracted, I think, partly because I'm half Chinese and half Welsh, to think about the way that railroad is built by Chinese labor coming from the west towards the center of the country and by Irish immigrant labor coming from the east towards the center of the country for those mm-hmm. two to meet. You know, there's a way in which the Celtic and the Chinese are meeting in that space, and that appealed to me, I think, because of my own family background. But it also reminded me that here's a huge civil engineering project, a real nation-building project that binds the country together, east and west, in the immediate aftermath of the Civil War, which has threatened to tear the country apart, north and south. And that nation-building is affected by immigrant labor on both sides.
And the other one, that it was heartbreaking, the story in the early years of Hollywood of Anna May Wong, the first Chinese film star. And as you tell her story, and I was checking up on her because I'd certainly been aware of her, she had it. And she was a fashion icon, and she had talent. But talk to us a little about how the Hays Code really kept her career from blossoming.
Right. Well, so one of the things she struggles with is the idea that the portrayal of interracial relations on screen is impossible. It's also illegal in many parts of the U.S. She couldn't herself in her life marry a white person, though she had many white lovers, mm-hmm. Because of limitations. And, of course, as somebody who's the product of an interracial marriage, somebody who's in an interracial marriage, that predicament seemed very powerful to me in various ways. But I'm also, you know, all of these characters, this is true for Vincent as this mm-hmm. iconic sort of tragic figure. This is true for Ah Ling, who's a real historical figure, but a real sort of footnote in history, overlooked really by the history, and Anna May as well. They're all characters who struggle with a burden of representation. How do these individual Chinese and Chinese Americans somehow represent or speak for a group? And it's an impossible burden, right? They're caught up in the ambiguities of that. They all, I think, fall short of it because no one person can speak for a larger group because, of course, what we fall into in that space, even if we represent that group positively, is the danger of stereotype.
You touch on your own background, having grown up in Coventry, Welsh father and a Malaysian Chinese mother. Did you have that experience of being other as you were growing up?
Yeah, I very much felt that where I was growing up. You know, the space that I was in, the city I was in, largely white. Mm-hmm. And even though I knew one or two other Asian children in school, you know, one of those kids was, you know, his parents were both Chinese, but they were Chinese from Jamaica, so it's a very different background. Another one was half Filipino. So while we were clumped together in various ways, we're also very different, right? And I vividly remember that odd burden of representation, that impossible burden of feeling as a child, particularly as a young child. I'd be waiting at the bus stop, you know, in a line of people, British people, white people, feeling like, well, I need to be the polite guy here. I need to be well-behaved because I want them to have this good impression of, you know, colored people in certain ways.
Boy, that's a lot of pressure on young
kids. It's a ridiculous pressure to take on board, right?
Yes.
It's a false burden to take on.
But understandable.
Yeah, exactly, I think. That feeling of how do I represent everybody else? It's an impossible space to be in, but something that we struggle with. And I think these characters struggle with it as well. To some degree, writing about these characters is a way for me to explore that struggle for myself.
Very much so. And I read you actually did your undergraduate work in physics. That's something else. You came to mind actually last night. I had a really great conversation with a first-generation Vietnamese woman who's a student. She's an undergraduate student. And she said there was such a strong stereotype because she's Asian. She was going into a STEM field. She said it was such a stereotype, and she wanted to write. So she is an English major, and she wants to teach someday to, writing at the college level. Did you feel those pressures as well?
I felt some of those pressures. Some of them are stereotype pressures. Yeah. Some of them are economic pressures. Right? I was growing up in the 80s. You know, I think some of the same economic pressures that were felt in Britain and the U.S. then are felt in Britain and the U.S. now. Mm-hmm. And so the idea of doing a sort of science degree or a, you know, a hard science degree, that feels like, oh, there's a job at the end of that, and the way that liberal arts education feels like that doesn't necessarily guarantee
get a paycheck.
Right. Yeah. But I also found that while I was, you know, good to some degree at physics, you know, I was very good at math, very good at exams. I didn't really have a talent for physics in itself, that it wasn't what I loved doing. And that it felt like it would somehow be a burden to spend the rest of my life doing this thing that I might be good at but not talented at, good at but didn't love doing. So it took me some time to figure out that I wanted to change the direction of my life.
And when did you first begin writing?
Oh, you know, I think what derailed my physics career, such as it was that I'd written my first what I like to think of as serious piece of fiction just before I went to college. I had aspired before that point to be a science fiction writer. I don't mean to suggest that science fiction isn't serious. I just wasn't very good at it. I was trying to write, you know, space opera in certain ways or write on the page Star Wars or things along these lines. And but in that period of my late teens, my grandmother was diagnosed with Alzheimer's. She went into, at that time, a pretty grim home. And that was a very difficult passage for my family. And I began to write about that. And I think in that process discovered some of the resources in fiction emotionally that felt really important to me. There was a new depth to the writing. And I, you know, I sent that story out to some magazines and got a scribble note back from an editor when I was about 18. And I could barely read his handwriting, but I figured out the one word he'd written back was the word possibilities. Mm. And the hope of that, that one word of encouragement, which is about as much encouragement as I got for 3 or 4 years, essentially derailed my entire physics career. Because although I finished that degree, always at the back of my mind was this feeling of, I should try this writing thing.
It was like a seed that got planted and it had to kind of grow. Now, did you have to leave England to be a writer?
I've said that, and I do think there's something to be said for that, right? I felt like I was surrounded by friends and family members who knew me in various contexts, right? Knew me as a son, knew me as a physicist. I knew nobody, probably even at 6 degrees of separation, who aspired to be a writer. In Britain at that time, there was no teaching of creative writing. One of the reasons I love doing it here is because it feels to me that pretty much everybody who goes to college in the U.S. knows somebody or has the opportunity to take a creative writing class. That seems like a very fundamental democratization of art. When I was growing up, you know, who was the most famous young British writer? It was Martin Amis. His father was Kingsley Amis, another great famous British writer. I thought that's how you became a writer. You were born into it, like becoming, if you're Prince Charles, you get to be the king one day, right? So the idea that somebody would teach you and help you to do that was really eye-opening to me. And so moving to the U.S., I got out from under the skepticism of family members and friends. Like, you want to be a writer? That seems like a terribly pretentious thing to do. And my own skepticism as well, and moved into a space where people were not going to look at me and say, you're trying to be a writer, that's crazy, but just, you're trying to be a writer, how could you try to be a better writer? That's the more practical and useful way of thinking about it.
Which you found once you came here.
Yeah.
I'm talking with writer Peter Ho Davies, his new novel, The Fortunes, exploring the Chinese-American experience over the past 150 years. I'm wondering, Peter, as you stand in front of your students now at U of M, are you getting a sense that the students of Asian background, the students of color, are they having a different experience than the characters you draw for us in The Fortunes?
That's a really interesting question. If you'd asked me that question even 2 years ago, I might have said yes and envisaged a more optimistic sense for them and for the future. Today, at our particular historical moment, I have some more questions about that. Right? One of the reasons why the Vincent Chin section reverberates. This is one of the odd things about writing historical fiction. Sometimes you write it because it reflects on the present. Sometimes the present reflects on the historical fiction. Mm-hmm. So, you know, one of the things we think about with Vincent's killing is that it comes out of a space of economic anxiety and the rhetoric associated with that, that comes out of the unions, that came out of the car industry, came out of our local politicians blaming Japanese imports for the decline of the American auto industry in the 1980s. And that rhetoric and that environment and that atmosphere of economic anxiety led to violence in this case and led to a hate crime, essentially. You know, so hopefully I'd like to think that revisiting a story like that revivifying it through fiction is a way of reminding us of some of the dangers that we faced then and that I think to some degree we still face now 35 years later.
Well, I'm wondering, you know, as you're saying these things, that I'm wondering what your thoughts were watching the presidential campaign and hearing Donald Trump say, "Make America great again," and seeing and hearing things said by supporters at Trump rallies. And we know from the Southern Poverty Law Center there's been a 900 reported, more than 900 now reported incidents of hate crimes and actions since the election. Is there a sense of deja vu?
There is. For me, that sense of deja vu comes both from the writing of the book, but also my own lived experience. One of the things I've been talking to my students about a little bit, historical fiction offers this perspective, but hopefully older people, and I now include myself in that category, at least compared to my students, can offer perspective in those regards as well. So again, when I was growing up in the 1980s in Britain, that was a period when the National Front in Britain, a far-right group, was in the ascendance. You know, skinheads were walking the street. I felt a degree of threat. I can vividly remember walking through a busy shopping street in my hometown in the early 80s and seeing a young boy, a teenager, he'd have been a little bit older than me, a Sikh in a turban running through the street being chased by some guys and thinking to myself, and not even comprehending what I was seeing, thinking, what are these guys doing? And only understanding, of course, when the guys caught him and threw him to the ground and put the boot in, that what this was, it was taking place in front of me. That's a dismaying space to be. One of the things that I also remind myself in that moment is that while a lot of the people on that busy shopping street did nothing, I think not because of they were afraid of intervening, but also because they just couldn't comprehend what they were seeing. The person who stepped in was my father. A white man, grew up in a rural space, not college educated, and he stepped into that space and pulled those guys off him and off the kid and sent those guys packing. That's encouraging to me, right? I think back even to the bands I used to listen to in Britain then, bands like The Clash, right? Who were tough, punkish, white working class bands, but also at the forefront of the Rock Against Racism movement, right? I always felt as a young person of color in Britain, in spaces that could be a little threatening, I kind of thought, well, I've got Joe Strummer of The Clash. He's got my back. I have the
and
toughest
tough.
White. I have the toughest white guy on the block on my side. Mm. That's encouraging. I take some hope in this because it feels to me that we are at a moment, I know some of my students feel this, where there can feel like a very sharp division in the country between people of color, between immigrants, and a kind of white working class. In a different historical context, in a different place, white working class people and immigrants and people of color were politically aligned. Right? That's my experience from my time in Britain. So the divisions that we see here do not seem essential. I don't feel as though my anxieties here are about the white working class per se. Maybe my anxieties about those who would seek to divide us. But I do think there are, in those historical antecedents, both the anxiety and the sadness that we're back in that place, but also notes of hope that we were in that place once and we got out of that place. And although we may be back there again, the cycle can turn yet again.
Well, I got to say, The Fortunes is a beautiful read. I can understand the glowing reviews that are all over the internet for The Fortunes. It's a beautifully drawn book, and these four stories are very, very memorable. Peter Ho Davies, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.